Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lady. The Warwick Slasher, a moniker that was given to the person who murdered four people in the town of Warwick, Rhode Island. The crimes would span the course of 2 years, with the first murder occurring in 1987 and the final one in 1989. The brutality and savagery of both murders would leave the town to question who in their community could be responsible for wreaking such havoc. The answer would come in the form of a child so hungry for the thirst of blood that he committed murder just because. Okay, on to the show. Craig Chandler Price was born on October 11, 1973, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to devout Baptists John and Shirley Price. The youngest of three children, he was known as the more rambunctious and comical one. He was always joking, running around, and unfortunately, getting hurt. The Price family moved in 1978 to 76 Inez Avenue, in the Buttonwoods section of Warwick. He had several accidents during his time in the neighborhood, but the most notable one occurred when he was 3 years old. He snuck out of the house and was hit by a car. Luckily, he only sustained injuries to his leg. At the age of 5, his pastor told his mom that Craig was important to this world and that he was destined to make an impact. She took this to heart and would remind her son, along with her other children, that they were children of God, entrusted to them so that they could teach them how to live properly during their time on earth. As parents, they took this role very seriously and tried to instill good values into their children. By all accounts, he had a normal childhood. His classmates would describe him as a big marshmallow, always surrounded by a group of friends and always telling jokes. He often defied authority, but it was expected with kids his age, testing limits and pushing boundaries. How far could he go until he got in trouble? As Craig grew older, he would be introduced to cigarettes, marijuana, and LSD. He was tempted to push his limits even further, and despite being a good-humored kid, he was beginning to rack up quite the rap sheet. It was full of crimes from petty theft, burglary, even vandalizing vehicles in his own neighborhood. As expected, this caused tension in his home. His father tried to reprimand him, but found that he was no match for his 13-year-old's temper or strength. He was already tipping the scales at 200 pounds and was around 6 feet tall. Shirley and John were left confused by their son. He was always so humorous, and despite his size, he could be gentle and caring, at least towards Shirley. Craig and his father often brawled to the point that cops were called to break up the fight. His parents didn't know that Craig had a rage boiling inside of him, and it was about to spill over and wreak such havoc on the town of Warwick. Craig recalls being 9 or 10 when he first wished death upon someone. A death that was brutal and painful, a death only he could deliver. The moment occurred when Craig was going to race his prized Roadrunner bicycle against a kid's brand new Huffy. He decked out the bike in Pepsi Blue. His dad worked for Pepsi and he was incredibly braggadocious about this. As he geared up to begin the race, he heard someone yell out, "Hey, spear chucker." He felt an object hit his leg and noticed that it was a golf ball. He looked back to see who was yelling at him, and he saw two teenage boys. They were white. He ignored them, but then heard the N-word come his way, and he was infuriated and then embarrassed. They continued to throw golf balls at him while insinuating that he had stolen his bike. Craig persisted and completed the race. He began to bike home and noticed that they were following him in their car. As he pedaled faster to try and get away, he inadvertently ran into a curb and threw the bike down with so much force that the chain broke. The boy sped off, and he was relieved until he saw the damage to his bike. He knew once his father saw it that he would be upset. And Craig was right. After his father saw the damage, he spanked him for the infraction. Too overcome with embarrassment, he made no mention of how it occurred and just apologized. He wasn't able to find an outlet for his anger, and he continued to let it build up inside of him until he exploded. His solution was to turn to drugs like marijuana and LSD, often combining the two. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the side effects associated with marijuana and LSD use eliminate control over a user's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. When you are in such a vulnerable state, you cannot make good decisions, you do not care for your safety, and you put yourself at risk. On the night of July 27, 1987, Craig made up his mind to murder. He was 13 years old. He contemplated how he wanted to do it. He already knew who he was going to target. 27-year-old Rebecca Spencer, a mother of two, living in a rental home with her brother Carl. He knew that she had visitors, and all he wanted to do was bash their skulls in. He thought about her two kids, Stephen, who was 8, and Danielle, 4, and what it would be like to murder them as well. His house was quiet that night. His mother and siblings were asleep, and his father was working the night shift. He grabbed his bat and made his way outside. He walked up the driveway of Rebecca's home and found the house empty. He was disappointed and made his way back home to get high. He mulled over the missed opportunity, and as he smoked his blunt, he began to think of more ways to cause havoc. He stared at her house and had another idea. He could go back and vandalize the house. He could smash everything, and then maybe he would be satisfied. He finished smoking, but left his bat and made his way back to her home. He jumped a fence and landed in her backyard. It was faint, so it must have been a TV. He kept his excitement at bay and made his way to a window. He knew Becky, as he called her, was moving away. The visitors he saw earlier were packing small boxes into their cars. He continued to peer through the window and saw something. Someone was asleep on the floor in the living room. He figured it was Becky's brother Carl, and he made his way into the home through the back door. He crept slowly into the kitchen and peered over at the person sleeping on the floor. He couldn't believe it. It was Becky. She was wearing her nightgown and most likely exhausted from the big move that was pending. He stepped back into the darkness and contemplated on what to do next. He thought about burning the house down, but in the mess of her home with all the boxes, he wouldn't be able to find any matches. He could strip some wires and maybe cause an electrical fire, but that wasn't going to work. She would probably wake up, cause a ruckus, and bring attention to the house, and then he would get in trouble. He looked around and found a 10-inch carving knife. He stood over her for some time before deciding to make a move. He leaned over her and stabbed her in the chest, burying the knife into her until it reached the hilt. He was electrified, and so he continued. She attempted to thwart his blows, but was unsuccessful. By this time, he had stabbed her so many times and in fatal areas that any one of the blows could have led to her death. In total, he stabbed her 58 times, and when he was done, he observed his work and left the house through the back door. He threw the knife into some bushes and ran back to his home. A thought came over him. He had touched some of the objects in the house, and those could be tied back to him. So he made his way back to the home and took what he thought would incriminate him. For some reason, on his way back, he was not concerned with these items any longer and threw them back into some bushes. He changed out of his bloody clothes, stuffed them in garbage bags, and threw them in the attic, and he went back downstairs to wash Becky's blood off of his hands. He smoked some more marijuana before dozing off. The next day, Becky's brutally stabbed body would be found in her living room. The scene was incredibly bloody, An investigator searched the area for clues. They noticed a blood trail in the driveway and began to search around the perimeter. They would find the murder weapon in her backyard. Cops began questioning neighbors and asked if they had noticed anything suspicious that evening. Kids who were playing by the house that night gave statements of seeing a man drive down the street. He began yelling at them, telling them to get out of the middle of the street and get out of the way. One of the children who provided a statement, a two-page statement as a matter of fact, was Craig. He was later interviewed along with a friend by a local news station. The reporters asked how they felt about the killing occurring so close to home. His friend said that he was scared, and Craig just nodded and agreed. Although what he really felt was that he was getting away with murder, and it thrilled him. He promised himself that he would never speak of the cruel act he committed. He wanted to move on with his life and try to do better, but it wasn't that easy. He was 13 years old, and although he tried to push his thoughts away, subconsciously, he was always thinking of the murder. He took LSD daily to distract him from his thoughts. He would continue to get in and out of trouble. He would be arrested for burglary with a group of friends, but only be given probation. The fights at home escalated and on several occasions involved his sister Kimberly. His father would try to break it up, but the end result would be Craig and John fighting until the cops came. Craig was arrested and charged with domestic assault, and again, he was just given probation.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
It was now 1989, and things only worsened for Craig. His parents were incredibly stressed by his behavior and acting out. His friends were beginning to distance themselves. Craig felt rejection like he had never felt in the past. This was unacceptable, and most importantly, embarrassing. He was always known as the funny one, but lately people were just avoiding him on purpose. He felt the same urge wash over him. It was unavoidable at this point. A few weeks earlier, he had met his neighbor, 39-year-old Joan Heaton, and her two daughters, 10-year-old Jennifer and 8-year-old Melissa. They lived just a street down from him. He was on his way home when he noticed that Jennifer had slipped the chain off of her bicycle. He offered to fix it and felt Joan was watching him with suspicion. Did she think he was going to steal their bike? The thought stayed with him until September 1st, 1989. He went to a beach party at Greenwich Bay. He was high on LSD and marijuana. He was beginning to get angry and made his way over to a teenager who had beer. He had asked for one, but was denied because the guy was running low. He simply said that was cool, but left after 20 minutes. On his way home, he passed by the Heaton home. He noticed Joan staring out the window. When she saw him, she closed the blinds, and he was immediately enraged. He made it back to his house, but could not quell his anger. He tried to smoke marijuana to relieve it, but the last few weeks kept playing back in his mind. He wanted to know why she was so suspicious of him. He couldn't shake the way she looked at him that day when he was fixing her little girl's bike, or just earlier in the evening, closing the blinds so quickly. Was it because he was black? The thought made him seethe with more anger, and he decided to fix the problem. He would kill her, and she would never look at him again. He donned similar apparel that he wore the night he murdered Becky. Black sweats, black shoes, and black gloves. He took a screwdriver and a 5-inch steak knife from his kitchen. That night felt eerily like July 27th, 1987. He perused the backyards of his neighbors until he arrived at the Heaton residence. He thought Joan was married, so he intended to take the husband out first, then her, but he would let the girls live. He didn't know that she was a single mother, just like Rebecca. He made his way to the back door, but found it was locked. He moved on to an open window and cut the screen. He took his shoes off as to not disturb the sleeping occupants. Still high on LSD, he began hallucinating about Becky's murder. He shook off the vision and made his way to Joan's bedroom. He found that her door was closed, and as he went to open it, his screwdriver fell from his waistband. He quietly ran back to the kitchen and hid, waiting to see if he had been discovered. When he didn't hear any footsteps coming, he made his way back to her room. He was about to walk in when he heard footsteps. He tried to blend into the darkness, but was discovered by a small hand that grazed his stomach. It was 8-year-old Melissa Heaton. Surprised, she jumped back and turned a light on. Craig was discovered by the person he intended to let live that night. He couldn't take that kind of risk and covered her mouth with his hand and carried her back towards her room. He tripped over something and she fell out of his grasp. She screamed and Joan came out of her room within seconds. The scared child ran over to her mother, who ordered her to call 911. Craig searched for his knife but dropped it when he tripped. He ran to the kitchen and grabbed another one. He returned and stabbed wildly at Melissa. Then he tried to stab Joan, but she fought him desperately, and he lost the knife again. He turned on the light and found that it was at his feet. He looked around and saw Melissa was on the floor in the kitchen, slowly dying, while Joan was lying hurt in the hall. Jennifer had come out of her room, and she was kneeling next to her mother, confused, scared, and mute. He knew that he had to kill her too, and he blamed Joan for messing up his plan. He looked at her and turned the lights back off to finish what he came to do. He was covered in blood. He collected himself and ran back towards the house. He followed the same routine, collected his clothes, threw them into a garbage bag, but instead of going into the attic, he hid the bag behind the garden shed in his backyard. He felt panic embrace his mind, and he began to wonder about all the evidence he left behind. He returned to the home hours later to clean up, and he couldn't stand being at the scene any longer, so he covered them with rugs or blankets and went back home. He took a shower and washed the blood of the Heatons from his body. 2 days would pass before Joan and her daughters were discovered. The medical examiner's report concluded the following. Melissa Heaton's body was in the kitchen. She had been stabbed 7 times in the neck, chest, and shoulder. She had been beaten on the head, neck, and upper back. The force was strong enough to crush her skull. She had 30 stab wounds in total. Jennifer Heaton was in the hallway. She had 62 stab wounds to the neck, chest, abdomen, arms, and legs. She had contusions to her head and neck, a fractured skull, and the snapped-off fragment of a blade embedded in her neck. Joan was in the hallway as well. She had 11 stab wounds to the face, neck, chest, and right shoulder, contusions of the head, neck, and chest, skull and rib fractures, and blunt force trauma injuries to the upper thorax and face. In total, she was stabbed 57 times. The evidence collected from the scene included large bloodied sock prints, a palm print on the dining room table, and blood spatter that indicated the attacker may have injured himself. Police speculated that the murders of Rebecca Spencer and the Heatons were connected. There were similarities that couldn't be ignored. As the investigation continued, they began searching for someone who had a laceration on their hand. On September 5th, just 4 days after the murder, Craig was spotted by Officer Raymond Pendergrast, who knew him from coaching some youth programs. He noticed a gauze-covered finger on his left hand. He asked what happened to him, and Craig said he fell on a glass bottle. He didn't seek medical attention because he hated needles and doctors. Pendergrast recorded the statement and continued with his investigation. This interaction led Craig to believe that police were onto him, that perhaps he had left some evidence behind, a clue that pointed in his direction. It was far too risky to return to the home during the day, so he waited until night. He entered through the same window and wiped down items he believed he touched during the murders. He spotted a police car outside and made his way back home. What he didn't notice was a bloody palm print he left on the table. Pendergrass was not convinced by Craig's statement, and a few days later contacted his parents and asked them to bring him in for questioning. When asked a second time about the cut, Craig demonstrated how he fell on the bottle. Detectives told him that it was impossible, so he tried confessing to a vehicle burglary, but again, was told that the wound did not match. He was released into his parents' custody, but was asked to return on September 16th. He provided a statement denying responsibility for the murders. He was given a polygraph examination and failed. Craig again stated that he got the cut from breaking into a car, but detectives told him again it was impossible. They showed Craig a picture of the Heatons, and he screamed immediately that he hadn't killed anyone. He told them to go ahead and arrest him now, since they were obviously trying to pin the crime on a black person. They released him, but a friend came forward and gave a statement to police that Craig had asked him to lie about the car break-in. With this information, they executed a search warrant at the Price residence. The family was placed in the living room while police searched the residence. 15-year-old Craig, unbothered by this, fell back asleep on the couch. He heard someone ask, "Where does this door lead to?" And his mother answered, "The backyard." Nervousness suddenly rushed over him, and he bolted up and requested to use the restroom. At first, the officer said, "No, you need to stay in the living room." But he lamented and said he really needed to go. So they allowed him, and Craig stared out the window in the bathroom to see what the officers would find. When he saw them pull out the bloody clothes and weapons, he went back into the living room and sat down. Minutes later, police arrested him for the murders of the Heaton family. They walked him out, and the scene became chaotic. His mother began to cry, and his father was screaming that they had the wrong person. Neighbors saw Craig being ushered to a police car, and that familiar wave of embarrassment rushed over him. 16 days after the murders, Craig Price would confess to the murders of the Heaton family, along with the murder of Rebecca Spencer. They wrote that his mother quietly sobbed by his side as he recounted his actions in 1987 and 1989. He showed no remorse during this confession. Since Craig confessed to the crimes, there was no need for a trial. Still a juvenile at the time of both slayings, state law did not allow juvenile offenders to be held past the age of 21, no matter the crime. He would be released on October 11th, 1994, his 21st birthday. He was remanded to the juvenile facility in order to undergo psychiatric evaluation. The evaluation was being used to potentially confine Craig for life in a state mental hospital. Prosecutor Jeff Pine was adamant that Craig was never going to be free. When Craig's attorney caught wind of the intentions behind the mental evaluations, she ordered him to stop speaking with the doctors. Craig's time in juvenile detention would be marred with controversy. On several occasions, he got into fights with other inmates and even threatened to kill an officer. As a result, in 1993, he was charged with extortion and assault for screaming at the officer. Craig denied the charges, but was found guilty. He addressed the court in December of 1994, stating, "To say I am not being pursued both legally and publicly with a racial vengeance is like saying America wasn't built on slavery." He was sentenced to an additional 15 years, with 8 suspended. In 1997, now Attorney General Jeff Pine requested that Craig be charged with criminal contempt for refusing to comply with the mandated psychiatric evaluations. He was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years. 15 years would be suspended with good behavior. He continued to receive additional jail time for fights with other inmates and for cutting a guard's finger with a homemade shank. He was denied his first opportunity for parole in 2002 and again in 2009 as a result of the continued fighting. Price's current scheduled release date is December 2020. He will be 46 years old. The resulting impact that Craig's late sentencing had on the juvenile laws in Rhode Island changed dramatically. Although they couldn't be retroactive to his sentencing, it did increase the amount of time that juvenile defenders could be held past their 21st birthday, and the nature of the crime would also be taken into account. For Rhode Island, this was a win. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and positively review on iTunes. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. We're also on Instagram. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, you can email us, TCFCpod@gmail.com. We also have merchandise up on our website now, so if you want to check it out, just go to truecrimefanclub.com/store. I want to give some shout-outs to some pretty awesome people, groups, and other shows. First, to my Patreon supporters, Monique, Dina Marie from Twisted Philly, Aaron and Justin from Generation Y, Brooke from Actual Innocence, Allie from Insight, and Marcy. She's been a listener since the beginning. I'm incredibly humbled that you're willing to help support the show, and it truly means the world to me. I can't wait to deliver exclusive content just to you. To those who are not currently on Patreon, I will be releasing patron-only mini episodes very soon, so be sure to join the club so you don't miss out. If you're looking for a group of people to share this podcast with, or if you want to find other great podcast recommendations, check out the Podcast We Listen To group on Facebook. It's one of the best places to go to find new and interesting podcasts. Plus, you get to interact with podcast hosts like me. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out these true crime podcasts. Detective Society, for fans of true crime, comedy, culture, and storytelling. Detective Society is written, hosted, and produced by Natalie Levy. Each week, she explores the darkness that lurks in Washington, D.C. Join her as she digs up bodies in her own backyard. Insight. Each week, Charlie and Allie dive deep down the rabbit hole and discuss unsolved crime, mysteries, and game-changing true crime cases, bringing them into clear sight. Already Gone Podcast. Already Gone features older cases and lesser-known stories from the Great Lakes region and beyond. Hosted by my favorite buttery-voiced friend, Nina Instead. If you're looking for something other than true crime and liked my last suggestion of Ghost in the Burbs, then you'll definitely love Pleasing Terrors. Join acclaimed ghost storyteller Mike Brown for a bi-weekly tour through the shadows of history. The Pleasing Terrors podcast features stories about haunted places, creepy history, and forgotten folklore. Okay, that's all I got. Until next time.